I'm going to preach from a stool for the first time. Never done this before. There was a sweet mom in our church that was like, did you hurt your back or something? And I'm like, no, back's great. I just feel like this is a conversation that it'd be best to sit. I don't know. There's something about this on, it's a serious conversation. It's a deep book. There's a lot of hurt and stuff like that. And so I think it'd be helpful posture to not be like standing and preaching, you know, but just kind of sitting and communicating and having a conversation. So we're in the book of Lamentations. And so thanks for being here. 2022 was a really, really hard year for our church. If you were with us through it, loads of heaviness, of suffering, of grief, of sorrow, of things that were, that should not be. There's a girl in our church, Kiara, and she's, I think, 20 years old and got diagnosed with cancer. And she's a college leader and all that. And it was just hard to wrestle with this girl, you know, this young girl having this deadly disease in her and what's, you know, what was going to happen. And our church rallied around her and prayed for her. And there's a girl in our church too that was on a run and on a morning run. And people jumped out of their vehicle and started, jumped on her and beat her up. And it's just like, man, that just shouldn't be. Like, it's so hard to wrestle with some of those realities. We love sending. We're crazy about it as a church, right? We're going to raise up church planters and go. But we got last year, we've sent a lot of pastors, which is hard to send people always. And Brett Mungie is one of our pastors and such a gift. We got to send him to City Light North and he's a teaching pastor there. But it was just hard for us to lose his leadership and his preaching and all that. And then we ran after trying to buy Kelly's carpet on 46 and Vine. And it's 60,000 square foot. It'd be perfect for all that Jesus has done. Great location, great space, all of it. And our church believed that you guys gave, you were generous and prayed, and then it didn't work out. And we had to back out like the last minute. So it's a major disappointment, probably the biggest that I've ever personally faced in a ministry kind of environment. And then there's stuff like, if you guys know Ruth Kilzer and Skylar and Cassie, great friends of ours. Cassie served on our City Light Kids staff, and Skylar leads our college ministry. And their daughter Ruth last year got diagnosed with a brain condition and had to have 3 different brain surgeries, like 12 plus hour long surgeries. And walking through that grief with them, our church together, was just really, really difficult. And I'd say the saddest and the most heartbreaking was, if you know Brett and Mallory Armstrong, great couple in our church. They're physical therapists. They've been part of it since day one. Huge gifts in a million different ways. And they had their daughter, Livy, and she went to go be with Jesus. And it was just, it's hard to wrestle with the loss of little girl, you know? So all that to be said, this year's been extremely difficult, right? There's been so many things that have happened. And I found myself in the midst of this year going, I don't know what to say, and I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know what to say to people. I don't know what to say to God. I don't know what to do. I don't know. Should I pray? Should I read a book? It was so confusing, and it was such a challenging year. And so I thought, man, if I'm going through this, our church is probably going through this. And maybe you're not I'm new to the church and I didn't feel those things, but there's this sense in suffering, like, what do you do, you know, with your grief, with your sorrow, with your loss? What do you do? I think there's a few options that we naturally kind of employ in suffering. One is that we can just, as Christians, we can fake the peace, right? Act like everything's okay. We kind of slap, you know, everything happens for a reason on everything that happens. Or we kind of quote Romans 8:28, you know, God works all things together for the good of those who love him. We just kind of, and that's our smile. That's our, like, we're okay. And it's like, really? And, you know, we're at church, we're raising our hands to God, but alone we're raising a fist towards him in anger. You know, or we're smiling externally, but we're weeping internally, or we're saying we're fine, but we're actually falling apart. And we just, as Christians, feel like there's this pressure to kind of fake the peace because we can't, you know, we can't be not okay, right? It's like, where'd that ever come from? I think the second option is we just ignore the problem. We just act like it doesn't hurt as much as it does, or that we're not implicated by it, or we just try to think about positive things and don't let our mind think about what's happening or how hard it is or whatever else, and we just kind of try to ignore it, act like it's not there, and do other things to keep us busy. Or the last option is just numbing the pain, right? And this isn't faking the peace or ignoring the problem. It's drinking to forget. It's shopping to help fill that pain or whatever and substitute it for something else. It's traveling to feel better. It's binge watching something to be able to not let our brain sink into that spot where we're thinking about it again. And last year, I saw myself do all of those things. Telling people I'm doing fine when really I just truly was crumbling. Ignoring the problem and just trying to focus on all the good things that were happening or just numbing the pain. I couldn't fall asleep without the TV on because I'm like, if that turns off, my mind will start going and I won't be able to fall asleep. You know what I mean? Like, maybe you're there, maybe you're in those, or maybe that's what you do, but there's another option that the Bible presents, and it's called lamenting. Learning as a Christian to live with loss, to face our grief and our sorrow and our pain and our suffering and our questions head on, you know? And you get an invitation to be real, just to be clear, like with God. As Bob Walls once said, you can beat on the chest of God. Like, that's the kind of intimate relationship Jesus purchased for you on the cross. And so this book teaches us how to do that, unlike, I would say, any other book in the Bible. And so we don't have to fake the peace or ignore the problem or numb the pain. We get to really learn how to lament. And so this book, it gives us, remember I said, I didn't know what to say, I don't know what to do. It gave me vocabulary. And I think that's what it does. It gives us words to explain our suffering and our grief and our sorrow. This word gives us permission to wrestle with the wrongs that have been done either to us or through us or around us. This book invites us to go to God with raw emotion and real questions in a rough draft prayer, right? Just how it is. And so suffering is an unavoidable part of the Christian life. We don't get a free pass from it, right? We're all subject to it. And so God never promises that he would insulate us from suffering, but he does have something to say about our suffering, in our suffering, and through our suffering. And so that's what I'm hoping to draw out from today. To give context on this book, Lamentations, some of the guys are asking, where is this? It's after Jeremiah, before Ezekiel, somewhere in there. It's a small 5-chapter little book. But we're going to scan the whole book this morning. But to give some context, as you track through Israel's history, God's people, there's one predominant peak and there's one predominant valley. The peak is the Exodus. It's when, you know, they were enslaved in Egypt. They were hurting. They were worked thin to the bone, all of that. God hates his people in slavery, so he miraculously sends plagues, and Pharaoh frees up his labor, all the Israelites, probably maybe millions, and they go out, and the army chases them. They cross the Red Sea on dry ground. They're like, peace. And then God closes the water, the Red Sea, on the Egyptian army. They're washed away forever. And then it's like, hey, remember the promised land I promised to Abraham? You guys can get it. Go ahead. And then they're all afraid. They think, their walls are too big and the people are too big, so we can't go. God's like, okay, well, if you don't trust me, then you're going to have to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. The older generation of leaders is going to die. The younger generation can inhabit that new promised land that I've said I want to give you, but you're not taking. And then after 40 years in the wilderness, they finally get to go into the promised land. They cross the Jordan River. And in that space, God gives them, and you can read it for yourself in the book of Joshua, victory after victory after victory, territory after territory, city after city becomes theirs. They win all these battles. They take all the ground, all the land that God promised to them. They're in this land of milk and honey. It's beautiful. It's amazing. They build a temple. They establish kingdoms. Like, it's a great, beautiful moment in their history. It's the highlight. It's a peak. It's a mountain. And then they rebel. And they sin against God, and they worship other gods, and they turn their life, and Josh talked about this last week in Jeremiah, into they look no different from all the rest of the culture, and they've blended in. And God says, I told you that if you wouldn't be faithful, I would take all this away, and I'll take my hand of protection off. And so he does. He takes, remember, that was the peak. We're in the land of milk and honey. We got the promise in that God promised back to Abraham. And he takes his hand off because of their disobedience, and enemies invade, and they get taken into exile into Babylon, and they're there for 70 years. And remember, peak Exodus, valley exile. Like, that's what's happening in this story. And so this book, Lamentations, is written at the bare bottom of Israel's history. They had it all and they lost it all. They had the promised land. They were kings. Now they're slaves in Babylonian captivity. Does that make sense? So that's where this book is coming from. That's where these words are coming from. Now, Teach read scripture, and we had those couple, the steadfast love of the Lord. And anybody ever quotes Lamentations, they always go chapter 3, his mercies are new every morning. There's literally 100 plus more verses, and none of them are bright like that. Like, this is the only shimmer of light in the whole book. Okay, so, but it's helpful to know this is what lament is. It's getting honest with God in that sense. So we're going to look at two things. Like I said, I don't think we have language for suffering. And so we're going to talk about the language of lament. What do we say? What are words that we can grab onto to explain our sorrow or our suffering? And then second, we're going to learn how to lament. Like, how do we actually do that? And the book informs us to that too. Sound good? So first thing that we see in the book of Lamentations is the language is being helpless. I am helpless. And so we'll have all the verses up to you. You can track through. Like I said, it's only five verses or chapters, so you can kind of zoom back and forth if you want, but it'll be on the screen too. So Lamentations 3:7 says, "He has walled me about so that I cannot escape. He has made my chains heavy, though I call and cry for help. He shuts out my prayer." Lamentations 4:12 says, "The kings of the earth didn't believe, nor any of the inhabitants of the world, that foe or enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem." Do you hear that? He's explaining this sense of helplessness. Hey, it feels like God is so walled me into this suffering that I can't escape it. I can't get away from it. I'm helpless. And then he goes on to say, and all the kings of all the world and everybody in the world, they knew there's no way to break into the gates of Jerusalem. That's how strong and fortified they were. If anyone could help themselves, it was Jerusalem in this season. And yet they crumble and now they're in captivity. So it's this picture of helplessness. I can't control it. I can't work it. I can't make it. I had great walls. They all tore down. I don't have any sense of control. I'm helpless. Now, I've got a lot of struggles. And if you've listened to my preaching, try to be honest about what I've struggled with or whatever. But through my life, I don't think I'd ever struggled with anxiety. That was never a thing that was plaguing in me until January 17th, 2017, when a little girl named Gracie that's back there was born. And I love you, Gracie, but you caused Dad a lot of anxiety. But it was like this precious, beautiful little thing. And it felt like I had something really to worry about, you know? And I remember, like, my wife is like a master swaddler. I'm like, did you take a swaddling class like in college or something? But she was so good. It was so tight. I'm like, is she okay? She's like, yeah, she's fine. But every night I would literally, and it wasn't just the swaddling, it was just in general and all of it. But we were sleeping and I would literally lean over my wife because Gracie was in the bassinet on the side. And I would just peek over and try to look at just to make sure I could see her belly going up like she was breathing. You know, I'm like, okay. And I'd lay back down and 30 minutes later, and I'd just put my ear right next to her. I couldn't see it. You know, I'm like, okay, she's fine. This is before the owlet phases. You know, I'm like, dang, those things would have been amazing. But all that to be said, I just felt so anxious. And then we have my son Haddon, and that brought a whole new dose of anxiety because he has a lot of health stuff. He had an autoimmune thing and he's been in the hospital, all these different things. And I'm like, man, I'm just worried about him. And then we have my daughter Eden. There was even more worry and even more anxiety and even more opportunity. And I'm like, and I've tried to think about this. I don't think I'm anxious about anything else in life. And there's plenty I could be anxious about. I'm only anxious about my kids' health. Why? And I think my conclusion is it's because I don't have any control over their health. So track with me on this. Now, I know I don't have any control over all these other things. Anything could happen. But there is some sense of perceived reality. If I'm unhealthy, if the doctor's like, hey, your cholesterol's high, I can start eating Cheerios or something. I think that's advertised like low cholesterol, something like that. But, you know, I can eat healthier. I can work out. If my marriage is in a hard season, I can go to counseling. If I feel lonely, I can call my friends to hang out. If my budget's a mess, I can rework it. I can cut back spending. Like, there's so many things in life that I can kind of, in some ways, control. But I can't control my kids' health. I can't control if they have some type of condition or something happens to them. And I think that in that sense where there's one thing that very obviously I don't have control in other words, I'm helpless about, anxiety comes. And I don't like it. And I'm sure you feel the same way. Maybe it's kids, maybe it's something different, but there is this pervasive reality where I don't like being helpless. And there's moments when, you know, my son was in the hospital for about a week with RSV and pneumonia and all this other stuff and on oxygen, pretty all this. And I remember feeling completely helpless. I couldn't pray it away. I couldn't speed it up. I couldn't make him feel better. I couldn't do anything for him other than just wait and watch him suffer. And I hated that, being helpless. And so that's the first kind of language for lament. And there's a couple things we need to realize about suffering is and helplessness. One is you can't eliminate suffering. You can't. We can work as hard as we want. We cannot eliminate it. We are in a broken world, and sin has broken our relationships and our bodies and all those things. Like, we're going to live in suffering. And so Christians don't get a free pass. Our King suffered, so will we, right? You're subject to it. And number two, you can't escape suffering. Like, you might go, okay, I can't eliminate it, but maybe I can plan well enough or save well enough or work hard enough or be whatever to avoid. You can't escape it either. It's chasing down all of us. And number three, you can't expedite suffering. You can't speed it up. That's one of the worst parts of, like, okay, this is hard, but can we just get it over with? No, it's long, it's slow, and we just have to learn to live in it and with it, right? So the first thing is I feel helpless. I'm helpless. The second one is hopeless. I feel hopeless. Now, a couple verses, chapter 2, verse 13 says, "For your ruin is as vast as the sea, who can heal you?" By the way, it doesn't say God can right after that verse. Lamentations 3, 17, 18. "My soul is bereft," which means lacking or deprived of peace. "I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, my endurance is perished. So has my hope from the Lord." Lamentations 4, 17. "Our eyes failed, ever watching vainly for help." It's this sense of, is this ever going to be better? Am I ever going to have a season where I'm not suffering with this? Am I ever going to get out of this where it's just easy or happy or good or better or fill in the blank? And suffering has a way of just wearing down our hope, of just wearing on us. And it feels like it's just heavy and burdensome, and we just submit to it. It has a way of dimming our eyes to see the light at the end of the tunnel. Just, I am broken beyond repair. I am sad beyond celebration, right? I'm just hopeless. My eyes are literally, they're growing dim from trying to look for help. There's nothing out there. The third one is loss. And I would say this could be potentially the primary theme throughout the book of Lamentations is this idea of learning to live with loss. But if you look at Lamentations 7, 1-7, he says, "Jerusalem remembers in the days of her affliction and wandering all the precious things that were hers from the days of old." Okay, so it's this process where you're looking back on what once was but isn't anymore. And it's painful and it hurts. It's living with that loss. And so this is actually emphasized in every chapter. So look at this. Chapter 1, 1. "How lonely sits the city that was once full with people." Lonely. It was full, now it's lonely. "Is this the city that was called the perfection of beauty, the joy of all earth?" It's a great city. Now it's in ruins. Chapter 2, verse 15. Chapter 3, verse 14. "I have become the laughingstock of all the peoples. I was once the ruler, the king, promised land, victory. Now I'm the laughingstock." Lamentations 4:15, "Those who once feasted on delicacies perish in the streets." Lamentations 5:15, "The joy of our hearts has ceased. Our dancing is turned to mourning," right? It's loss, remembering what was, looking back on what once was and no longer is. It's the great reversal. And think about this in our lives. Think about lamenting loss in relationships. You think about, we're not as close as we once were. Like we, you know, it's a family member, it's a friend, it's whatever. And you're just lamenting that we're not as close as we once were. We don't have the same relationship we once did. Or you think about simplicity. It's life isn't easy as easy as it once was. It was easy to whatever, you know, just kind of come by. And now it's confusing and challenging. And there's all this stuff. Lamenting health. I can't do what I used to. Lamenting finances. I can't live how I used to. Lamenting death. It's not the same without them anymore. Lamenting peace. I can't sleep like I used to. I'm worried up at night. Lamenting trauma. I'm not as trusting as I once was. And now there's all this going on, right? But there's this reality where we live with loss. And we look back on what once was but isn't anymore. The fourth one is lonely. Yeah, this feeling of loneliness. And if you look at chapter 1, in verse 2, 7, 13, 16, 17, and 21, six times, it says this somewhat of this repeated phrase, "There is no one to comfort me." There's no one to comfort me. And so last year, in this idea of loneliness or not being comforted, last year, in the midst of all the stuff that I just mentioned in the beginning, Jeremy and Naomi, our worship staff, they put on this night of lament. And like everyone comes to a night of celebration, you know, like let's sing happy songs, let's do this stuff. And it was like, we're going to lament. And it was like, who's going to show up? And it was packed. It was beautiful. I was so humbled to be in the room for this night of lament. It was raw and it was honest and it was real. And at the end of the night, Jeremy had shared was honest with his things he's lamenting and things that are challenging in his life. And he said, hey, we can go to God, like honestly, you know? And so we had sticky notes and it was like, I want you to write what you're lamenting. Like if you could just gut level, what do you want to say to God? You know, like It's okay. Tell him. And so everyone's kind of processing, and we all wrote something down, and then we, on a sticky note, we put it on the stage. So there's hundreds of them up here, you know? And we, and so, you know, you're walking up and you're putting yours, you can see other people's and what they're saying. And it was just everyone getting gut level honest with God. And afterwards, you know what the most prominent lament was? I'm lonely. Nobody knows how I feel. You know, I'm isolated. And it's just suffering has a way of doing that to us. We feel distance from God. We feel distance from people. We just feel lonely. And it's okay to lament that. And but it's important to have that language to say, this is how I feel in this moment. And so, yeah, it's a sense of no one gets what I'm going through. No one's here for me. There's no one to comfort me. The fifth one is comparison. And so this Lamentations 1 says, her foes have become the head, her enemies prosper. And Lamentations 5:2, our inheritance is turned over to strangers, our homes to foreigners. So here's the idea of comparison. It's seeing others thrive when we're suffering, okay? And this doesn't matter if it's our worst enemies, like in this scenario, or our closest friends. So track with me here. You see somebody that you know get their dream job, and they're loving it, they're posting about it, they're excited, whatever, and then every day you're driving to work and you hate the job that you're doing. You're reluctant to show up and put in another 8 hours, and yet you see someone else living out their dream job. Or your kid is maybe developmentally behind. They're not walking soon enough. They're not reading soon enough. They're not progressing. They're not as athletic. And then you see another kid that's younger than your kid and is doing more than what your kid has done, and they're younger, and you're going, what's going on? You know what I mean? And it's like, I'm happy for them, but also there's this sense in me where it's like, that's tough. Or you feel like your marriage is hanging by a thread and you're barely getting by. And then you see somebody else post that they're on vacation with their spouse and they're living it up. And it seems like their marriage is great, right? For my wife and I, after we had Gracie, we're hoping to have our kids spaced out like 2 years, you know? And so we started trying for Haddon, and it was like 9 months that we had tried to get pregnant, and we couldn't. And we were so confused because Gracie was so easy or whatever. And so we're trying to get, and I know that 9 months in the span of so many stories that I know, that's like nothing. But for us, it was really unique, and we were mourning that, and we're lamenting that sense. And so we go over to our best friend's house, Nate and Becca, at City Light in Omaha, or City Light North. And they're like, we get done with dinner, like, guys, guess what? And we're like, what? They're like, we're pregnant. And there was a sense in us that was so happy and so broken, because it was a fresh reminder that we weren't pregnant, you know? And it was such a weird sense in my heart of like, I'm so happy for you, but it's also a clear reminder in that comparison reality that I don't have what you have right now. And you get what I'm saying? Like, there's just that sense of lament of, I'm seeing someone have what I want and I don't have, and I'm suffering and they're thriving. It's just hard. And the very last one is confusion. A language for lament is, I'm just confused. And so Lamentations 5:20 says, why do you forget us forever? It's talking to God. Why do you forsake us for so many days? So, I mean, anyone that suffered knows this is a primary question, right? Wondering why all this is happening. Why me? Why the person I love? Why not someone else? Why now? Why not later? Why, you know, I mean, all of these senses that are culminating, I think we really want suffering to be logical. Like, there's a reason for it. Like, we could point to something, oh, that happened, so then that happened. We're just scratching for some type of reason or logic or explanation to why we've gotten to the place we've gotten. And we don't have that. And there's a sense in lamenting that we're just confused. I don't know why this is happening, and I hate it. So that's the language of it, right? I'm helpless. I'm hopeless. There's loss. I'm lonely. I'm comparing, and I'm confused. But it's helpful to know when you're in that lamenting season to be able to put some words to it. Like, that's what this book gives us, is language and verses to explain and express how we're feeling in a biblical sense from God and His inspired word to go, wow, like, someone else felt this too. I'm not alone. And be able to put words to it. So that's the language. And I didn't teach, I didn't relieve it with the gospel, I didn't do it, but I want us to sit in that moment and feel that. And now I want us to actually teach us through Lamentations 3 of how to actually lament, like that we would learn to lament. So if you got Lamentations 3, we'll walk through it a little more verse by verse. But I want to read, first thing is in verses 16 through 18. This is chapter 3. It says, he has made my teeth grind on gravel and made me cower in ashes. My soul is bereft of peace. I have forgotten what happiness is. So I say, my endurance has perished and so has my hope from the Lord. The first thing you want to do if you want to learn how to lament is you've got to call it like it is. You've got to call it like it is. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, and I'm crazy about Jesus's grace and his forgiveness, but I think that it's like his gospel isn't just that he forgives us and that we get into heaven. It's that we are actually brought into an intimate personal relationship with God, our Father. You understand that? That it's not just like, hey, you're good, go do your thing, but you get a real affectionate relationship with the God who put the stars in the sky. And not only that, but it's such a real relationship that he's giving you permission to be gut level honest with him. And I don't think we understand that. It's like we want to start all of our prayers with Heavenly Father, and we think they need to be prim and proper and polished. And I'm like, no, that's not the relationship Jesus purchased for you, right? It's so much more deeper and real and richer and fuller and more beautiful and raw than that. And so I just want you to know, you can tell God how you feel. And you're like, wait, can I really? Can I be honest? Like, is he going to strike me down? Like, isn't that disrespectful? It's like, did you just see Lamentations 5? Why have you forgotten us? Why have you forsaken us for so many years? You read the Psalms and David's like yelling at God. You know what I mean? It's like, and David doesn't die. Not only that, but God uses it as an example on how to talk to him. And I just think, I don't know if any of it, like, we really know how to tap into that. It's like, wow, Jesus has purchased me an intimate relationship with God where I can actually tell him how I feel. And he's not like, whoa, 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 whoa. We don't have that kind of relationship. You know what I mean? And so you can beat on his chest. You can give him your rough draft prayers and rant, not a polished presentation. And if you know me, you know I'm not an angry person. That's not like a natural emotion for me. But I remember when my son Haddon was in the hospital, and I had left to go home and take a shower and hang out with Gracie, and Kristen was there being mama bear to Haddon the whole time. She's amazing. And I remember getting in my car and punching the steering wheel and screaming at God. And I remember just in rage, like I was just so mad. And it was like this weird moment where I kind of paused and I was like, oh my gosh, Scott, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it, you know? And I remember just thinking like this weird sense in my heart of like, I didn't mean to yell at you, you know? And I'm sorry. And reading the book of Lamentations, you know what I think he would have said in that moment? Thanks for finally being honest with me. You know what I mean? Like, thanks for taking advantage of the kind of relationship my son bought you. You can yell at God. It's not disrespectful. It's a real relationship. And he's not interested in your pleasantries. And so I just think we need to take advantage of that. Like, it's a permission to be honest with him. And so he's not fragile. You're not going to hurt his feelings. Let him have it. He can handle it. So number one, if we're going to learn how to mend, we got to call it like it is. Get honest. Number two, you've got to call to mind who God is. Okay, you got to call to mind who God is. So that's what he does. He finishes it. He goes, verse 19, he says, remember my affliction and my wanderings, the wormwood and gall. My soul continually remembers it and is bowed down within me. So this is what I'm remembering, all the bad stuff. Verse 21, but this I call to mind, or this I remember, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They're new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will have hope in him. So he calls to mind after he just got gut level honest. You're dragging my teeth through the gravel. This is terrible. I remember all of it, but call it like it is. I'm going to call to mind who God is. And he goes, three things. You're loving, you're merciful, and you're faithful. And so he says, your love never ceases. Basically, you have affection like a well that never runs dry. It never runs dry. It doesn't have an end to it. It's a bank account that can't be overdrafted. His love never ends for you and I. You got to call that to mind. And he says, in your mercy, it's new every morning. And it's like, it's new for old sins. It's new for past sins. And every single morning, you get fresh mercy on your plate, washed in every single morning from God. And number three, God's faithfulness. He's great, inconceivably faithful, even when we're unfaithful. So he's going, we don't deserve love, we deserve anger. We don't deserve mercy, we deserve wrath. We don't deserve faithfulness, we deserve faithlessness. And all of that, he goes, no, you're loving, you're merciful, and you're faithful. And that's what he's calling to mind. So you have to, in your own sense, figure out in those moments, what do I need to figure out and call to mind on who God is? Maybe it's loving, mercy, faithful. Maybe it's generous. Maybe it is present. Maybe it's his humility. Maybe it's his compassion. But there's something about God that you're calling to mind in those moments of lament. And if I can just be totally candid with you guys, one of the biggest fears that I have in my life is basically the idea of when is the shoe gonna drop? You know, like I'm 31 years old. I have a beautiful wife. I've got 3 amazing kids. I have my dream job getting to love and lead this church. Like we've got a great home and my family's healthy and all the things. And I just feel like it's too good. Like the shoe's going to drop. Like something bad has to happen. Someone's going to get sick. Something's going to collapse. Something. And I just feel this weird sense in my heart. And I'll literally lay in bed at night and just think about all the ways that everything could crumble. And I have to call to mind, wait. Jesus said in Matthew 7 that God's a good father, loves to give good gifts. I'm thinking in this moment that he's thinking about planning how to take it all apart. What? That's not who Jesus said God is. He loves to give good gifts. Just in the same way I love my kids. Or it's not a prosperity thing. That's just a father thing that he loves to care for us. And I'm like, I shouldn't be surprised. I should be grateful and I shouldn't be afraid of losing it all. I should be enjoying it knowing my father loves to give good gifts. Amen? Does that make sense? So it's like, call to mind who God is for those particular seasons. Where are you thinking of him wrongly? So you got to call it like it is. You got to call on who, or call to mind who God is. And the last thing that he shows us is you've got to call on God for help. You've got to just literally ask him. You got to call on God for help. So he continues in verse 55 in chapter 3, and he says, I called on your name, O Lord, from the depths of the pit. You heard my plea. Do not close your ear to my cry for help. You came near when I called you. You said, do not fear. You've taken up my cause, O Lord. You've redeemed my life. And so we just got to call on God. So I'm going to tell you like it is. I'm going to remember who you are, and then I'm going to ask for your help. And so I was thinking help on four things for help. What could you ask? Number one, help to believe who God really is. So you might be a pro at having your, you could have a little cute list on your phone of when I'm suffering, who is God? When I'm afraid, who is God? But that doesn't transfer always from here to here, does it? And so you're asking God, help me believe the things that I'm calling to mind. I can say it. I want help to believe it. And you're asking him, help me believe what I know to be true about you. Number two is help to bring you near when you feel far off. Okay? It's like James 4. If you draw near to God, he'll draw near to you. There's this sense of saying suffering has a way to push us, to make us feel lonely, a pervasive sense. And it's just asking God, I know suffering is going to push me from you, from everyone else. Bring me near. Let me feel your nearness in this moment. Number three, help to become more like him through this. Okay, so Romans 8:28, everyone loves to quote that God works all things together for the good of those who love him, right? And we go, oh, that means that I had a breakup, but I'm going to get a better significant other, or I lost my job, but I'm going to get a better job. That's not what it means. No one knows verse 29 or quotes it that says his will is that we would be predestined to be conformed to the image of his son. So the whole reality of verse 28, the good that he's working through everything is that he is making us more like Jesus. That's what verse 29 is saying, those together in the context. So you're asking through a suffering, I hate this, but God, don't let it go to waste. Make me more like you through this thing that I'm experiencing and suffering, right? And I had all B's, so I kind of had to work this one a little bit. The last one is help to buoy through the storm, right? Help to buoy. But this is an idea. Mentor of mine, Gavin Johnson, told me this last year in the midst of all the stuff. And he said, man, I feel like God has given you a gospel buoyancy. And it was this really vivid picture of this idea of staying afloat in the midst of what everything is pulling you down. It's asking God, help me buoy, in this storm. And Isaiah 43 verse 2 says this beautifully. It says something to the effect of that when the waters rise, he won't let me drown, And so when everything's coming, he's keeping me afloat. I'm staying afloat in this thing. So call it like it is. Be honest with him. Call to mind on who God is. What do you need to know about him in that moment? And call on him for help to believe or to become or whatever that may be, right? So I need to make a distinction really quick. There's punishment, and this book uses the word punishment, and there's discipline, and those two things are very, very different. So I want you to know, if you are a Christian, if you've submitted your life to Jesus for salvation, believing that you couldn't save yourself, you weren't good enough, Jesus is perfect in your place, you believe in his death and resurrection, you're a Christian, God will not and does not punish you. You need to hear me. He does not punish you. So I know the instinct. I'm a pastor who preaches on this, and I feel it in my heart. When something goes wrong, I think God's mad at me. And I'm just telling you, that's not true. You're not going to find that in light of his grace as a bought and redeemed and adopted son or daughter of God, okay? So you don't get punished. He doesn't get mad and lash out in anger towards you. You do get disciplined. And that's what Hebrews 12 talks about and says that a good father does discipline his kids. And by the way, discipline's never fun. I think it says that, and he's like, God doesn't discipline, in verse 33 in chapter 3, he doesn't afflict from his heart. He's not happy to discipline. You know, when I have to put Gracie on timeout, or I'm like, I just want to be like, let her run. You know, that's not a good dad, though, to not discipline. And so, kids, you know that. Like, it's loving for us to be able to be involved in your guys' lives. And so that's what God does. It's kind of this wake-up call to say, hey, I got to discipline you. I got to wake you back up to the reality, and you're straying from it, and I'm pulling you back in through this discipline. So I want you to know that. But so it's not punishment, it could be discipline, or it could just be we live in a fallen world. So when you're wondering why is this happening, it could just be the result of being around in a broken world with broken people. That's where you're going through what you're going through, right? But even in that, right, discipline is this corrective sense, but even in that, Romans 8:28 says God is gonna use it instructively in your life. So even if it doesn't have anything to do with you, the suffering you're experiencing, if it's not discipline or whatever, it's definitely not punishment, if it's not discipline, it could just be God using that in your life, allowing it and saying, I'm gonna make you more like me. Don't worry, I know this hurts. I don't like it at all, but I'm gonna use this to make you more like myself. Does that make sense? But look at chapter 5, look at the last few verses. These are so sad. These are so sad. I'll read verse 20 through 22. We've read this before. He says, why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us for so many days? Restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as old. And verse 22, this is how it ends. Unless you have utterly rejected us and you remain exceedingly angry with us. Anyone else kind of hate that it ends like that? You know, like there's no high note. There's no gospel promise you can find in there to be like, oh yeah, maybe there's a hint to this. It's just literally the book ends with wondering, with a question. Maybe you have rejected us. Maybe you're finally done with us. Maybe you're so fed up with our rebellion that you're like, you know what? You've worn all my patience down. You're done. Maybe you're exceedingly angry with us. Maybe your mercy's run out and all you have left for us is wrath and anger. That's how the book ends. And I just wanna say, for anyone in the room that hasn't trusted in Jesus, this might be your posture where you're kind of like, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I'm good with God. Maybe I'm not. Maybe he's mad at me. Maybe he's happy with me. Maybe I've done enough. Maybe I haven't. And even for the Christians in the room, this might be pervasive too of going, I don't know. You know, it's hard to believe the gospel. I know what I did last night. I know what I did a couple years ago. I knew what I did last month. And you might feel like, has God just given up on me? And am I too much of a work in progress? And I want you to know, again, I'm going to read this. Unless you have utterly rejected us and you remain exceedingly angry with us, Jesus in his life speaks to both of these things. Doesn't it? Like the gospel is so sweet to finish this and answer this wondering. He had every right to reject us, right? Our lives are drenched in sin in every single way. Things that we should have done, good that we haven't, and things that we shouldn't have done, and we have. All of that are in complete rebellion from God. And he has every right to reject us, to leave us, to wallow here on earth and suffer the consequences. But he didn't. What's he do instead? He comes to us. So he doesn't reject us, he comes to us and he enters into our lament. For time's sake, I can't, but I was gonna walk through 5 or 6 different examples of Jesus lamenting it. Lazarus's death and with Mary and John the Baptist and when he looks over at people's rebellion and even at the cross, like all these moments where Jesus is lamenting. He doesn't reject us, he comes to us experiencing our suffering and lament, enters into it, laments himself rather than rejecting us. And all the way to the point of dying on the cross, and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's lament from Psalm 22. That's his saying, in a gut level, I'm forsaken. And although we deserve to be rejected, Jesus doesn't, only person ever that doesn't deserve to be rejected, he gets rejected for us, takes on our rejection, takes on Lamentations 5:22, And the father looks at him and rejects him because he puts our sin on us. And then now, in a great substitution of grace, he gives us his acceptance. So the way that the father would treat the son, he now treats us if we trust in Jesus. And the way the father should have treated us because of our sin, he treated Jesus like that. Does that make sense? It's so important to understand. And so no, he doesn't reject you. He's accepting you through his son's righteousness on your behalf. And we're going, I wonder, has he rejected us? And he goes, is he angry with us? Exceedingly angry with us. And I want you to know, Jesus shows us the heart of the Father is not anger towards you. He shows the prodigal son in Luke 15, and he shows this picture of the father, and this prodigal son's run away, and the dad isn't behind the door, locked, you know, you're done, with a little letter saying, don't come home, you're done, I'm done with you, you've spent all everything. He's waiting on the porch, watching, ready to get up and run to you. He's not mad at you. He loves you. He's for you. And by the way, the prodigal son's story isn't just for the new believer. It's for the seasoned believer that keeps running away. That's the gospel. And so no, he's not mad at you. He loves you. That's what Jesus purchased for you. He delights in you. He's pleased in you. The same way the father looks at his son, he looks at you. Last night, my wife and I were driving back from my in-law's cabin and hadn't fell asleep before we even hit the interstate. I love that guy like a crazy amount. And I just kept looking back at him. I just kept kind of popping back and I'm like, gosh, I love him. I kept doing it. And I was thinking about this sermon. I just thought, man, it's crazy that that's the way the Father feels about me. That's the way he feels about you. That he would turn his head around and look at you and go, man, I love her. And I love him. So has he rejected us? No. You're accepted through Jesus. Is he mad at you? No. He delights in you because of Jesus. That's the gospel hope that we have. Not only that, it gets even better. In the midst of all our lament that we need to learn how to live with for the rest of our lives, there will come a day that Jesus will put an end to our lament. Amen? Revelation 21:4 says he's going to wipe away every tear. Death will be no more. Mourning will be no more. And there will be a day we look forward to where we don't have to learn. We can forget to lament. We don't have to know it anymore. We'll live in a day where everything wrong has been made right, where he's redeemed what it should have been, where we're in perfected bodies with him forevermore in his new creation. That's the day we look forward to. So he's not angry, he's not rejected, and lamenting will come to an end.